that is one of 400 lawsuits that a lawyer has filed. And when we talk about frivolous, we've got to talk about this, and I think it'll be an interesting discussion. And then also outrage over a Southwest Airlines pilot saying, "Let's go, Brandon," which is the new, it's a code for F Joe Biden that comes from a sort of confusion during a car race that took place. We'll explain it all, but a Southwest Airlines pilot essentially saying F Joe Biden during his pre-flight announcement to passengers, audible gasps were heard in the cabin and demands for the pilot to be fired. He should be fired. He should be fired. Political statements, I believe, are against company policy for pilots for basically every airline. So we will talk about that and much more when producer Pat joins me on today's bonus show. Get instant access by signing up at
We at WRCT Pittsburgh do not condone the illegal duplication of copyrighted material. But if you happen to own all the tracks we played and would like a copy of them, just FTP to FTP. Due to a request by Computing Services, the remainder of this announcement cannot
be. Hey, this is Marlon Saunders, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh. 88.3 FM.
Senator John McCain, and I'm from Arizona, but when I'm in Pittsburgh, I always listen to WRCT, one of the finest stations in all of radio, and Carnegie Mellon University is one of the finest academic institutions in our country. Be sure at your next election to vote early and vote often.
Hey, this is Ben Foles, and you're listening to WRCT. It's 2 for Tuesday, 3 for Thursday, Ladies' Night Wet T-Shirt Contest on 88.3 FM, biatch.
Thank you.
This is Brad Yoder, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
Hey there, this is MC Honky, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Is Mark G of the Evolution Control Committee, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, where the drunken pants are going wild.
WRCT, the in sound from way out.
Hovland, you're listening to 88.3 WRCT. FM. Pittsburgh.
Hi, we're the Deliverance Strangers, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
This is Danny Glover, and you're listening to 88.3 FM WRCT Pittsburgh.
WRCT, this is the place that sets the pace for Pittsburgh.
It's been a long time since you've touched the hand and the heart of that special someone. You're not alone. This is WRCT Pittsburgh's Radio Automation Service. Stay tuned for more tracks from our radio and record library.
Hello, I'm Meg Lee Chin, and when I'm in town, I like to listen to WRCT 88.3 FM.
Hi, you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, home of... Oh, crap. We're not really home of anything, are we?
Hi, you're listening to...
WRCT.
Pittsburgh. CMU. This is Sue Garner.
And Rick Brown.
Have some barbecue sauce.
Soon, pay toilets will take over the world, and everyone, everywhere will listen to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
Hi, this is Martin Atkins from Pigface, and you're listening to WRCT 88.3 FM.
Hey, this is Jim from Rusted Root, and you're listening to WRCT 88.3 in Pittsburgh. Yeah.
Or I'm from Creationist Crucifixion.
Arr, I'm not attractive and I'm from Steel Curtain.
Me neither, arr.
WRCT.
Pittsburgh, 88.3, arr.
Things get brighter day by day when you listen to the Big W. Life is lighter in every way when you listen to the Big W. So laugh it up and let yourself go with King Size Radio, the Big WRCT. Radio Carnegie Tech.
Hi, this is Felicia Collins from Late Show with David Letterman, and you are listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
You're listening in at your house, or you're listening in at your car. If you want to hear good music, you don't have to go far. 88.3 is the magic number. WRCT in at the Pittsburgh area. Who say so? I say so. Who is me? Maka.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
This is the challenge of our collective lifetimes, the existential threat to human existence as we know it. And every day we delay, the cost of inaction increases. So let this be the moment that we answer history's call here in Glasgow.
At the UN Climate Summit in Glasgow, President Biden vows to take action to address the climate emergency. But at home, his climate agenda has been dealt another setback, as Senator Joe Manchin says he's not yet ready to support Biden's slim down Build Back Better plan. We'll speak to Bill McKibben, the co-founder of 350.org, and Tom Goldtooth, head of the Indigenous Environmental Network. They're both in Glasgow. Then to a 23-year-old climate activist from Samoa.
Pacific youth have rallied behind the cry, "We are not drowning, we are fighting." This is our warrior cry to the world. We are not drowning, we are fighting.
We're broadcasting from Glasgow and New York. Then we look at Monday's Supreme Court oral arguments on the constitutionality of Texas's near total ban on abortions. We'll speak with the legendary lawyer Catherine Kitty Colbert, who argued the 1992 landmark Supreme Court case credited with saving Roe v. Wade. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. More than 120 world leaders gathered in Glasgow, Scotland, Monday for the opening of a crucial United Nations climate summit whose outcome could determine the future habitability of the planet. The COP26 Climate Change Conference, as it's officially called, opened with this dire warning from UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
Enough of brutalizing biodiversity. Enough of killing ourselves with carbon. Enough of treating nature like a toilet. Enough of burning and drilling and mining our way deeper. We are digging our own graves.
As COP26 got underway, leaders from over 100 countries pledged to end and reverse deforestation by 2030. India also unveiled its plan to reduce carbon emissions to net zero, but only by 2070. And the United States is announcing a new plan today to reduce methane emissions. Speaking to the assembled leaders, President Joe Biden apologized for former President Trump's decision to withdraw the United States from the Paris Climate Accord. Biden said the U.S. and other nations who've contributed the most to the climate crisis have overwhelming obligations to help poorer countries contend with the climate emergency. Biden's comments came just days after he called on OPEC to increase oil production to lower fuel costs. Thousands of protesters have assembled outside the climate summit demanding meaningful action to limit global temperature rise to 1.5 degrees Celsius or 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit. This is 19-year-old Mexican climate activist Maria Reyes.
My message for global world leaders is that they cannot have a climate negotiation without the people most impacted by the climate crisis present. If we allow them to do that, COP26 is going to be a rich people's conversation. And rich people are not most affected by the climate crisis. We are.
After headlines, we'll go to the COP26 climate summit in Glasgow for the latest. President Biden's domestic agenda was dealt a serious blow Monday when conservative Democratic Senator Joe Manchin refused to commit to supporting the Pare Down, Build Back Better Act, the 10-year, $1.75 trillion program to mitigate the climate crisis while expanding social programs. Among other things, the bill would expand clean energy programs, provide universal preschool to 3- and 4-year-olds, and expand Medicaid and Medicare. Manchin's opposition has idled a $1 trillion infrastructure bill passed by the Senate in August, with progressives refusing to approve the bill until they have assurances senators will pass the larger climate and spending package. On Monday, Senator Manchin said he needed more time to weigh the Build Back Better Act's impact on the national debt and the U.S. economy, even as he urged House Democrats to immediately vote on the infrastructure bill.
For the sake of the country, I urge the House to vote and pass the bipartisan infrastructure bill. Holding this bill hostage is not going to work in getting my support for reconciliation bill.
The U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments Monday on whether to uphold Texas's ban on abortions after 6 weeks before most people know they're pregnant. The law, known as SB 8, also allows private citizens anywhere in the United States to sue healthcare workers and others for facilitating an abortion in Texas. It's the most serious challenge yet to the landmark 1973 Supreme Court ruling Roe v. Wade, which guaranteed the right to an abortion. The court's three liberal justices asked if allowing the Texas law to stand would invite other state legislatures to pass laws invalidating other constitutional rights. This is Justice Elena Kagan.
We would live in a very different world from the world we live in today. Essentially, we would be inviting states, all 50 of them, with respect to their unpreferred constitutional rights, to try to nullify the law of that this court has laid down as to the content of those rights.
We'll get the latest on the Supreme Court and Texas's abortion ban later in the broadcast. Today is Election Day in the United States. In Virginia, a record number of registered voters cast early ballots ahead of today's highly watched governor's race between Democrat Terry McAuliffe and Republican Glenn Youngkin, a former CEO of the private equity firm that's backed by former President Donald Trump. Terry McAuliffe is close to Bill and Hillary Clinton, is one of the Democratic Party's most prolific fundraisers. He previously served one term as Virginia's governor, was chair of the Democratic National Committee from 2001 to 2005. Advisors to the Centers for Disease Control meet today to discuss the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine for children as young as 5. The FDA's already approved shots for 5 to 11-year-olds, saying the benefits of vaccinations far outweigh the risks to kids. The Biden administration says millions of pediatric vaccine doses have already begun shipping around the country and that inoculations could begin later this week once CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky gives the final green light. New York City has placed about 9,000 municipal workers who defied a vaccine mandate on unpaid leave. Mayor Bill de Blasio says 91% of New York employees got at least one shot ahead of Monday's deadline. In Illinois, a Cook County judge has blocked the city of Chicago's mandate that for police officers to get vaccinated against COVID-19 by December 31st, saying the issue should be settled in arbitration. Some 1,700 Chicago police officers report they're not vaccinated, and a further 3,000 have refused to report their vaccination status to Chicago. The UN Security Council has extended the UN peacekeeping mission in Moroccan-occupied Western Sahara for another year. The resolution, approved Friday, calls for a resumption of UN-brokered talks between Morocco, which has occupied the Northwest African territory since 1975, and the Polisario Front, the Sahrawi liberation movement seeking independence. Morocco's invasion set off decades of torture, disappearances, killings, and repression against pro-independent Sahrawis living in the occupied Western Sahara. Last November, Morocco violated a 29-year ceasefire with the Polisario Front, and war returned to the territory for the first time since 1991. To see our documentary, 4 Days in Western Sahara, Africa's Last Colony, go to democracynow.org. In Burma, local media is reporting military forces shelled a restive town in northwestern Chin State, destroying some 160 structures, including at least two churches. The UN and Rights recently warned the military junta, which overthrew the civilian government in February, is planning attacks in the region. Meanwhile, a new report from the Associated Press finds the Burmese military has been guilty of torturing prisoners since the February takeover. Over 1,200 have been killed and thousands arrested in the aftermath of the coup. In Afghanistan, at least 15 people were killed, dozens more injured after two explosions and gunfire hit a major military hospital in the capital, Kabul. There was no immediate claim of responsibility, but witnesses describe fighters with the Islamic State clashing with Taliban forces. The latest violence comes after the United Nations warned that without urgent action, Afghanistan is poised to become the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Families displaced by fighting have been living in tents as the winter cold sets in, with food remaining scarce. This is Halima, a displaced woman in Kabul.
So far, around 4 to 5 babies were born here, and then they died due to the cold. Yesterday, an elder man and a child who went on the streets to earn money for buying food had a car accident and both died. We are in very tough situations.
Back in the United States, some 10,000 John Deere workers vote today on a tentative contract that could end the strike they began October 14th. If approved, the agreement would bring the unionized workers an immediate 10% raise plus 5% raises in the contract's third and fifth years. The deal would also improve on employee pension plans and would pay workers an $8,500 signing bonus. It's a significant improvement from John Deere's final offer before workers went out on strike. In Wisconsin, opening arguments begin today in the trial of Kyle Rittenhouse, a white teenager who faces 7 charges, including homicide, for fatally shooting 2 men and wounding a third amidst anti-police brutality protests in Kenosha last year. There's only one person of color on the jury. Rittenhouse was just 17 years old in August 2020 when he brought an illegally obtained AR-15 semi-automatic assault rifle across state lines from Illinois and joined other armed white vigilantes in the street of Kenosha during protests over police shooting of Jacob Blake. The judge overseeing the trial has ruled the 3 protesters shot by Rittenhouse, 2 of them killed, cannot be labeled victims during the trial, but can be called rioters, looters, or arsonists if the defense can provide evidence to justify such terms. The U.S. Senate voted Monday to confirm Beth Robinson to the 2nd U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, representing Connecticut, New York, and Vermont. Robinson is a longtime LGBTQ leader who in 1999 argued a landmark case in Vermont that won broad legal protections for same-sex couples. She becomes the first out LGBTQ plus person ever to serve on a federal circuit court. Just 2 Republican senators voted to confirm Robinson, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska and Susan Collins of Maine. And in Washington, D.C., civil rights leader Reverend Jesse Jackson was hospitalized Monday after he fell and hit his head while visiting Howard University in support of student protesters. Jackson had been visiting with students at Howard, one of the nation's preeminent historically black universities, who began a sit-in last month to protest terrible housing conditions, including toxic mold, rodents and roaches in campus dormitories. Students took over Howard's Blackburn University Center and have been camping out in tents since October 12th. Before his accident, Jesse Jackson reportedly secured a promise from Howard administrators that students would not be expelled or suspended over their nonviolent protests. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We are broadcasting from Glasgow and New York. I'm Amy Goodman, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez, who is in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, we begin today's show in Glasgow at the United Nations Climate Summit. At the opening ceremony on Monday, United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres urged world leaders to do more to address the climate emergency.
The 6 years since the Paris Climate Agreement have been the 6 hottest years on record. Our addiction to fossil fuels is pushing humanity to the brink. We face a stark choice. Either we stop it,
or it stops us. And it's time to say enough. Enough of brutalizing biodiversity. Enough of killing ourselves with carbon. Enough of treating nature like a toilet. Enough of burning and drilling and mining our way deeper. We are digging our own graves.
Over 120 world leaders are attending a two-day world leaders summit as part of the climate summit. This is Barbados Prime Minister Mia Motley.
Failure to provide the critical finance and that of loss and damage is measured, my friends, in lives and livelihoods in our communities. This is immoral and it is unjust. If Glasgow is to deliver on the promises of Paris, it must close these three gaps. So I ask to you, what must we say to our people living on the front line in the Caribbean, in Africa, in Latin America, in the Pacific, when both ambition and regrettably some of the needed faces at Glasgow are not present? What excuse should we give for the failure? In the words of that Caribbean icon, Eddie Grant, will they mourn us on the front line? When will we, as world leaders across the world, address the pressing issues that are truly causing our people angst and worry, whether it is climate or whether it is vaccines?
A number of countries have made new pledges to address the climate crisis. India's vowed to reduce its carbon emissions to net zero by 2070. Over 100 leaders have agreed to end deforestation by 2030. And the United States is announcing a new plan today to reduce methane emissions. On Monday, President Biden addressed the UN Climate Summit.
Climate change is already ravaging the world. We've heard from many speakers. It's not hypothetical. It's not a hypothetical threat. It's destroying people's lives and livelihoods and doing it every single day. It's costing our nations trillions of dollars. Record heat and drought, fueling more widespread and more intense wildfires in some places and crop failures in others. Record flooding and what used to be a once-in-a-century storms are now happening every few years. In the past few months, the United States has experienced all of this, and every region of the world can tell similar stories. And in an age where this pandemic is made so painfully clear that no nation can wall itself off from borderless threats, we know that none of us can escape the worst that's yet to come if we fail to seize this moment.
On Monday, yes, President Biden addressed the UN Climate Summit. He later apologized for the United States pulling out of the Paris Climate Agreement when President Trump was in office. While Biden repeatedly vowed to address the climate crisis, his climate agenda was dealt a major setback back in Washington, D.C., when Democratic Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia criticized the slimmed-down $1.75 trillion Build Back Better plan to address the climate crisis and to expand the nation's social safety net. The plan will only pass the Senate if Manchin and Arizona Senator Kyrsten Sinema come around to support it. It was interesting. Senator Manchin used Biden's moment in Glasgow to hold his own news conference in Washington, D.C. to say, well, he's weighing whether to support the Build Back Better Act. To talk more about the UN Climate Summit and Biden's climate agenda, we're joined by two guests in Glasgow. Tom Goldtooth is executive director of the Indigenous Environmental Network, member of the Diné and Dakota Nations. He lives in Minnesota. Bill McKibben is an author, educator, environmentalist, co-founder of 350.org. His latest book, Falter, Has the Human Game Begun to Play Itself Out? He writes a weekly climate newsletter for The New Yorker. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! We're going to begin with Bill McKibben. Both our guests are in Glasgow. Bill, if you can respond to President Biden yesterday, the speech, both what's happening in Glasgow with the UN, with the world leaders, over 120 gathered. This is far different than any other time. And what's happening back in Washington, D.C., with Senator Manchin trying to steal the headlines.
Sure, Amy and Juan, what a pleasure to be with you. And it's strange not to have you here, I've got to say. Yesterday, the air went out of this conference, I think, pretty much right at the start. The hope was that Joe Biden was going to arrive with some legislative victories that would at least point us in the right direction. He doesn't. He arrives having approved more or less line three. And with nothing to show on the other side so far. The Build Back Better plan had already been stripped of its most important elements, the enforcement provisions under this clean energy pricing plan. And now it's not even clear it's going to pass. The $500 billion in subsidies for renewable energy are being held up by Joe Manchin's latest hissy fit. Mark my words, every single delegate from every nation heard Manchin's quote yesterday about how he wasn't at all sure he was going to vote for this. It makes it extremely difficult to proceed when the world's carbon champion, the country that's poured more carbon into the atmosphere by far than any other, won't provide leadership. Yeah, it's better than Trump pulling out, but I think that, you know, basically, it's a good thing that people like Tom Goldtooth are here, because this summit's not going to solve our problem. We're going to be back in the streets in a serious way.
And Bill, I wanted to ask you, first of all, about the Manchin new roadblock once again. Because Manchin is really basically a stand-in or a puppet for the fossil fuel industry. What does it tell us about the ability of these corporate powers to stymie the majority or Democrat or Democratic action just by being able to capture a few key senators? What's that tell us about the future of action by Democratic vote in Congress? And also, what do you make of Biden, on the one hand, making this strong statement in Glasgow, but just a couple of days earlier at the G20 summit, he was urging the industrialized nations to increase oil and gas production temporarily?
So Manchin is the perfect example of how big oil works. He's taken more money than any other senator from the fossil fuel industry. And, you know, there was that sting videotape released a couple of weeks ago where Exxon's chief lobbyist reported talking to him every week and calling him their kingmaker. There was a report yesterday that Manchin spent part of September huddled with all the leading coal barons at a golf resort someplace where they played a Civil War-themed golf tournament in between speeches. That sounds like a good deal of fun, I got to say.
Some have said, Bill, that Senator Manchin has to decide whether he wants to be a senator or a lobbyist or maybe a Republican.
Clearly, our system allows you to do both at the same time, Amy, and that's the problem. Look, credit to Biden for getting 48 senators on board with a serious progressive commitment around climate and other things. And that's because we've built movements, and that's because Bernie showed that there was a real appetite for this, but 48 isn't quite enough. And so I think one way to say it is movements have gotten big enough and strong enough to force the question, to call the question in Congress, but not quite big enough to carry the question. That's why I think coming out of this COP, those of us from all sorts of places, including Third Act, this new group we're doing with people over the age of 60, are going to be heavily focused on banks and the finance system. That's where groups like Indigenous Environmental Network were working 15 years ago, trying to interrupt bank financing for. And we're going to have to go back there, because there really is a sense here that the political system and the UN system are beginning to reach limits. They're not moving fast enough. They're not coming close to keeping up with the pace of the devastation. And so Greta pretty much captured it. There's a lot of blah, blah, blah. There is, and some of it's very noble and very powerful, and the people who are saying it are magnificent, but it's not adding up to enough. And there's a sense, as with Manchin, that we spend a lot of time talking to the cashier at the front of the store when our problem's with the guy in the back room counting the money. So I know I'm coming out of Glasgow determined to be taking on the Chases and the Black Rocks and whatever of the world just as hard as we can.
And I'd like to bring in Tom Goldtooth, the executive director of the Indigenous Environmental Network. Welcome to Democracy Now! Tom, your reaction to the opening of a COP26, what do you see? Is it a failure already at the start? And your perspective from the point of view of what the indigenous folks want out of this summit?
Well, Bill said something about a lot of the team players at the corporate and the country level having their war game plans. And this is what we've seen as indigenous peoples for these 26 years. I've been coming to these COPs since the fourth COP, number four. It's a continuing war against Mother Earth, against Father Sky. The violence that's perpetuated with the continuation of the dumping of toxic chemicals into the atmosphere, greenhouse gases, carbon. It's insane. The bathtub's overflowing. It has to stop. Our indigenous delegation that is here and the ones that are still coming here, we're saying, hey, this has got to stop. For our communities, our indigenous nations and communities from the United States, President Biden is here. We heard his presentation on the screen. He's continuing a U.S. legacy, of broken treaties. In his run for presidency, he said he's going to uphold the treaties of our indigenous nations and stop leasing public lands to the fossil fuel polluters. Instead, he's failed to stop the Dakota Access Pipeline. He's failed to stop the Enbridge Line 3 pipeline, and within an agenda of supercharging oil and gas leasing on pipelines and waters. This has to stop. The front lines to Washington, to Glasgow, we're telling Biden to reject big oil lies, ban federal oil and gas leasing, and stop the federal climate catastrophe. This has to stop. One of the issues that we're bringing to here as part of a national Build Back Fossil Free campaign, a movement in the United States between our indigenous nations, our black and people of color communities, and green groups, is to push Biden, but not only Biden, but also the northern industrialized countries to declare a climate emergency and keep fossil fuels in the ground and end that subsidies of fossil fuels globally, but back home domestically. We got to do that and end the federal fossil fuel leasing program. But one of the things that we're here to really lift up is this false solutions around net zero agenda. There's no problem about us pushing for a zero agenda emissions, but when they slide in the word net, that's when it really is problematic, and it's a process and what we see of not really cutting emissions at source, and it's the main buzzword here, net zero emissions, nature-based solutions, and net zero has nothing to do with reducing emissions to zero. It has nothing to do about cutting emissions at source at the level that we need to restrict the warming above 1.5 Celsius. It's very critical. It is an issue of life and death to many of our indigenous peoples from the north to the south. So that's why we're here to amplify that voice. Again, you know, we're asking that there be attention to this from the world leaders. But we're here not just alone. We're here with allies saying that this concept of net zero emission does not reduce it, pollution. And there's oil giants like Shell, like BP, like ExxonMobil, all claiming to move towards net zero. So that really it's a mechanism of greenwash. It allows them to increase drilling and burning fossil fuels and washing their hands of their responsibility for the climate crisis. They are climate criminals, and we're concerned that this conference of the parties is continuing to be a conference of the polluters.
Of course, conference of parties or polluters is represented by COP. COP. Let's turn to Bolivian President Luis Arce, who addressed the UN Climate Summit in Glasgow Monday.
We must be aware of the fact that developed countries are promoting a new global recolonization process, which we could call the new carbon colonialism. I say this because they're attempting to impose the rules of the game, their own rules of the game, to continue to fuel the new green capitalistic system and to enforce these rules of the game upon us, with us having no option. We will not solve the climate crisis with more green capitalism and more global carbon markets. We need to change the civilization model we have and head towards an alternative model, an alternative to capitalism, which is the concept of living properly together in harmony with Mother Earth.
So that is the Bolivian President, Luis Arce. If you could address this issue, Bill McKibben, the issue of climate capitalism and what it truly would mean to lay out the framework for a sustainable planet.
Well, let me say first, one of the things I'm doing today is addressing a memorial service for the 247 environmental activists that were killed around the world last year, many of them in Latin America. And in almost every case, standing up to defend something, a forest, a place that's about to be mined, from some large corporation or another. Now, the corporation didn't come out and kill them, but their orders trickled down to whoever was there on the ground and whoever pulled the trigger. And all of that is still underway. There's a kind of ongoing colonialism. Indigenous people suffer probably hardest from it than anybody else. And then a great percentage of those 247 bodies come from indigenous communities. So let's always remember that those lives are on the line. And so are the lives of, well, we know that breathing the combustion products of fossil fuels, from a big study released a few weeks ago, kills 8.7 million people a year on this planet. That's one death in five. It's bigger than HIV, AIDS, tuberculosis combined, malaria combined. And it's all unnecessary because we now are able to produce power by pointing a sheet of glass at the sun. Renewable energy is the cheapest power on the planet, but the reason that it's not rolling out fast enough is precisely because there is still this huge industry that's trying to make money off the end of the world. The news is not all bad. We are making some progress. We announced last week that the global divestment campaign has passed $40 trillion in endowments and portfolios that have sold their shares in coal and oil and gas. It's become the largest anti-corporate campaign in history. And it continues. Just yesterday, more universities divested. The Dutch pension fund, the fifth biggest in the world. We're going to keep that pressure on because money is the, you know, money is the oxygen on which the fires of global warming keep burning. And if we can snuff off that supply of capital, of finance, we can at least slow this down some, which we desperately have to do.
And speaking of the fires of global warming, I wanted to ask Tom Goldtooth. There's a recent United Nations report that warns that at least 10 forests designated as World Heritage sites have become net emitters of greenhouse gases and no longer absorbing more carbon than they emit. Could you talk about that and your reaction and what must be done and why governments need to react much more quickly to the crisis we're facing?
Well, here in the hallways of the conference of the parties here, our indigenous caucus from all over the world, we've been involved with a process of establishing protocols for sharing our traditional knowledge, our indigenous traditional knowledge with the nation states. And that's a very important and critical part of the history of this UNFCCC meeting, because it's going to be the application of our indigenous traditional knowledge that we feel is a solution. It's a solution to this world crisis. And we've been saying that all along with our delegation for years, is that we have to look for solutions that are real solutions, real reductions that cut emissions at source. And that's one reason that we've been looking at ways to build mechanisms in different countries, especially those countries that are rich in trees, forested areas, especially the Amazon and the tropical regions. But that also means our forested regions of the north. We need to do that. We need to restore. We need to have healthy nature. But one thing that we have to also lift up that's part of our spiritual knowledge, our traditional knowledge, is that we cannot sell Father Sky. We cannot sell Mother Earth or the trees in a capitalistic project. And climate capitalism is something that's going to affect our people. So we're for these conservation projects, biodiversity protection projects, but outside of a carbon market system. Traditional knowledge means that the government's going to have to wake up and have to cut emissions at source, keep fossil fuels in the ground, and restore and maintain our healthy ecosystems of biodiversity.
Well, we want to thank you both for being with us. And, of course, we're going to continue this conversation. Tom Goldtooth, Executive Director of the Indigenous Environmental Network, member of the Diné and Dakota Nations, usually as in Minnesota, today in Glasgow. And Bill McKibben, co-founder of 350.org. His latest book, Falter, Has the Human Game Begun to Play Itself Out? And we'll link to his pieces in The New Yorker, his weekly climate newsletter. Coming up, we speak with a 23-year-old climate activist from Samoa. She addressed the UN Climate Summit yesterday. Stay with us.
And although I won't cross that blue hue inside, tell me now, blurry life, what's our big mistake? Strange hell sitting here breathing, knowing it's too late. And all the while, naked world's turning inside out. And all the while, We ain't walking without you tonight. Hurry words, missing turns, darkness, handsome fight.
Wind Conversation by Helado Negro. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We're broadcasting from New York, New Jersey, and Glasgow, Scotland. As we continue our coverage of the UN Climate Summit, we turn to Brianna Fruin, a 23-year-old climate activist from Samoa. She addressed the world leaders Monday.
I don't need to remind you the reality of vulnerable communities. If you're here today, you know what climate change is doing to us. You don't need my pain or my tears to know that we're in a crisis. The real question is whether you have the political will to do the right thing, to wield the right words, and to follow it up with long overdue action. If you're looking for inspiration on this, look no further than the climate leadership of young Pacific people. We are not just victims to this crisis. We have been resilient beacons of hope. Pacific youth have rallied behind the cry, "We are not drowning, we are fighting." This is our warrior cry to the world, "We are not drowning, we are fighting." This is my message from Earth to COP. I hope you remember my words today and look closely at your words as you go throughout COP, because e pala ma'a aile pala upu. Thank you.
That's Brianna Fruin, the 23-year-old climate activist from Samoa, speaking at the UN Climate Summit Monday, member of the Pacific Climate Warriors delegation at COP26, youth representative of the Pacific Climate Warriors Council of Elders, joining us from Glasgow inside the COP summit. Brianna, that was an incredibly powerful speech you gave yesterday, addressing your elders with youth wisdom. Can you talk about where Samoa is, the distinction between Samoa, where you live, and American Samoa, and what it is, what the climate emergency means for your island nation?
Yes. So I'm from Western Samoa, and there is the American Samoa part of our islands. And so we were split colonially. One went to America, and then one went to other colonial powers, but we gained our independence. So I'm from the independent state of Samoa, and it's a beautiful island within the South Pacific Ocean that's unfortunately feeling the impacts of climate change every day. It's in our livelihoods. It's at our front step. It's our everyday reality.
Ask you, Brianna, to talk about what you demand and if you think what's being proposed at COP26 is sufficient.
For a long time, Pacific Islands have known that this is a problem. It's not news to us that climate change is real. We've known it for decades because we experience it firsthand. And so our call has always been to keep fossil fuels in the ground. We need to be drastically lowering emissions and to make sure we can stay below that 1.5 threshold. And so that has always been our call to action, to end all fossil fuels, to phase out of that fossil fuel era and move towards renewable energy, as well as another call we are now asking is for climate damage to be financed. There's no such thing as climate aid, it's climate debt. You know, bigger countries that make money from the fossil fuel industry, that make money from extractive industries, owe us debt because we are experiencing the consequences of their inaction.
And could you talk about what the consequences would be for Pacific Island nations like Samoa of global warming going above 1.5 degrees Celsius, what the projections are?
Yes. So the recent IPCC report, the projections are that low-lying atolls have around a decade. If we're lucky at the current trajectory that we're on. And so for our smaller islands, it means the end. That is the sentence that world leaders if we are no longer making those ambitious actions. The sentence is they're giving us the end. And so, you know, even though we are the ones who will be experiencing that first, we won't be the ones experiencing it last, because whatever happens to the Pacific will happen to the rest of the world. And so the call from the Pacific Islands is, if we're able to save the islands, we're able to save the world.
And could you talk about your own development as a climate justice activist? You started at the age of 11, how you first got involved and what drove you?
Yes. So I first heard about climate change when I was 11 years old in a primary school classroom. And I remember turning to my classmates saying, we need to do something. And so we started an environmental group and started the 350 Samoa chapter in our island. And we were the youngest ever community leaders in that climate space. And I've been in the climate space ever since. But I truly believe in the power of our young people, and the thoughts that we have can be really powerful in this space.
I wanted to get your response to a remarkable UN ad that was put out last week. We're going to play that ad, Brianna. It was a dinosaur addressing the United Nations. It was released by the United Nations Development Program, showing a computer-generated dinosaur addressing the UN General Assembly. The dinosaur is voiced by Jack Black.
Listen up, people. I know a thing or two about extinction. And let me tell you, and you'd kind of think this would be obvious, going extinct is a bad thing. And driving yourselves extinct in 70 million years, that's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. At least we had an asteroid. What's your excuse? You're headed for a climate disaster, and yet every year governments spend hundreds of billions of public funds on fossil fuel subsidies. Imagine if we had spent hundreds of billions per year subsidizing giant meteors. That's what you're doing right now. Think of all the other things you could do with that money. Around the world, people are living in poverty. Don't you think helping them would make more sense than, I don't know, paying for the demise of your entire species? Let me be real for a second. You've got a huge opportunity right now. As you rebuild your economies and bounce back from this pandemic, this is humanity's big chance. So here's my wild idea. Don't choose extinction. Save your species before it's too late. It's time for you humans to stop making excuses and start making changes. Thank you.
And especially for our radio listeners, that was a dinosaur addressing the UN General Assembly. Don't to confuse him with Jack Black, who voiced it. Brianna, your final comment.
Yeah, that was a powerful statement. And I think it's a real thought in our minds now that, you know, in humanity, we've made a lot of mistakes. We've had war, we've had famine, we've had a lot of instances where we've put humans in danger. Never ever in the history of this planet have we lost a country. Have we been able to say, wow, a country just completely drowned underwater? And so if we're able to really think about the islands, think about extinction, and save our Pacific Islands, I think that can be our first step as humanity. We need to look out for each other, and everyone can't just think that this is just an issue for the Pacific. This is an issue for the rest of the world.
We thank you so much for being with us, Brianna Fruin, climate justice activist from Samoa, member of the Pacific Climate Warriors delegation at COP26, youth representative of the Pacific Climate Warriors Council of Elders, speaking to us from Glasgow. When we come back, to the United States to look at Monday's Supreme Court oral arguments on the constitutionality of Texas' near-total ban on abortions. We'll speak with the legendary lawyer Kitty Colbert, who argued the landmark Supreme Court case credited with saving Roe v. Wade several decades ago. Stay with us. Dig Me Out by Sleater-Kinney. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The Supreme Court heard oral arguments on Monday on whether to uphold the most restrictive abortion law since it decided Roe v. Wade in 1973. Justices heard arguments in a pair of lawsuits that challenged the Texas law known as SB 8, which bans abortion after 6 weeks, before most people know they're pregnant, and allows private citizens anywhere in the United States to sue healthcare workers and others for facilitating an abortion in Texas. The lawsuits challenging the ban were brought by President Biden's Department of Justice and a coalition of abortion providers. During nearly 3 hours of oral arguments, Texas argued before the court that neither case can proceed because the state is not the proper defendant, since SB 8 bars state officials from enforcing the law. But a majority of justices raised concerns about how Texas designed the abortion ban to protect it from judicial review. This included two of President Trump's appointees expressing concern, Justices Brett Kavanaugh and Amy Coney Barrett, who voted in September to allow the law to take effect. The court's three liberal justices asked if allowing the Texas law to stand would invite other state legislatures to pass laws invalidating other constitutional rights. This is Justice Elena Kagan.
That's right. You know, and we say that we would live in a very different world from the world we live in today. Essentially, we would be inviting states, all 50 of them, with respect to their unpreferred constitutional rights, to try to nullify the law of, that this court has laid down as to the content of those rights. I mean, that was something that until this law came along, no state dreamed of doing. And essentially, we would be like, you know, we're open for you're open for business. There's nothing the Supreme Court can do about it. Guns, same-sex marriage, religious rights, whatever you don't like, go ahead.
That's Justice Elena Kagan. Supporters and opponents of abortion rights protested outside the Supreme Court during Monday's hearing. For more, we go to Catherine Kitty Colbert, longtime public interest attorney who argued the landmark case before the U.S. Supreme Court in 1992, which is credited with saving Roe v. Wade. She's co-founder of the Center for Reproductive Rights and co-author of Controlling Women, What We Must Do Now to Save Reproductive Freedom. Her column in Monday's New York Times is headlined, Roe is as good as gone. It's time for a new strategy. Thanks so much for joining us, Kitty Colbert. You listened to the oral arguments yesterday. What's your takeaway?
Well, Amy, thanks so much. It's great to be here. My takeaway is that this particular case, the two cases that the court heard yesterday, are not really about abortion at all. They're about the rule of law and the ability of plaintiffs or people suing to get into federal court to redress their grievances. And as the clip you played from Justice Kagan showed, the court was concerned about the fact that that avenue had been blocked by the Texas legislature, and other legislatures could do so on a whole host of issues. And I think they were concerned about that. Let's be clear, however, that these cases are not about abortion. They're not about whether or not the Texas law is unconstitutional because it violates the right to choose abortion. Instead, it's about who can you sue, can you get into federal court, the very, very complicated question of sovereign immunity, which I won't even begin to go into, but it was what kept the court engaged for about 3 hours of oral argument yesterday.
And Kitty Colbert, you've made the point that the more significant abortion rights case is still coming up before the court. That's going to be Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization, the Mississippi case. That's coming up on December 1 for oral arguments. Could you talk about the difference in that case versus this one?
So in the Mississippi case, the court is confronted with the direct question about whether Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey remain the law of the land. It is a challenge to a ban on abortion at 15 weeks of pregnancy. And under the current law, Abortions are available up until viability or much beyond that, up until 23 to 28 weeks. And therefore, it's really important for us to keep our eye on the ball. That is, the court, we could get a win in the Texas case and lose the whole ball of wax in Mississippi. Because once the Supreme Court, as we expect, opens the door to a whole range of bans on abortion before viability, they can do so, a whole lot of states, I think as many as 20, will begin to ban abortion. And then the women in those states will suffer irreparable harm.
And if that were to happen, what do you see then as the strategy for those who support a women's right to choose?
So thanks for asking that, because I think the most important thing is we have to keep we have to make sure that we don't keep hitting our heads against the marble staircase. Save Roe, save Roe, save Roe has been our mantra for so many years, and it no longer works because of the ultra-conservative nature of this Supreme Court. We must instead look at three things: helping the women in the states that are going to ban abortion, and that could be as many as 20 or more states. It'll range in area from Georgia to Texas, from North Dakota all the way south to Arizona. Huge land areas in this country, abortion may be banned, and therefore we've got to help those women get safe and legal procedures. But most importantly, in my view, we've got to turn to the politics of this issue. We've got to turn to the political process and begin to take back those state legislators by electing people who are champions of the cause, electing people who will preserve women's rights, and begin to think about that as our most important task. Because until we control the legislatures of all of those states that will ban abortion, we will not be safe.
You had this interesting headline today where Beth Robinson has been named as the first out lesbian LGBTQ plus activist to the federal bench. And I was wondering if you can talk about the significance of that. I mean, her groundbreaking work is really as an activist as well as a lawyer.
And that's great. I have to commend President Biden for a host of appointments to the federal courts that are terrific and which will begin to chip away at the damage that President Trump did to the courts. But let's be clear here. The Supreme Court is what matters when it comes to the federal court system, and that court is stacked with six conservative justices who will either whittle away or totally eradicate the rights we have all been relying upon for the last, at least in the case of Roe, for the last almost 5 decades.
So let me ask you about Justices Kavanaugh and Amy Coney Barrett, what their arguments were. In fact, Kavanaugh and Elena Kagan were really echoing each other. They were saying, this isn't about abortion anymore. This could be about gun rights and state legislatures going after gun rights in this different kind of legal strategy.
Yeah, I think both Justice Kavanaugh and Justice Barrett were concerned with the breadth of the Texas law, the fact that it really prevented people from going into federal court to sue. It delegated the state's authority to any individual to enforce the law. That just is a radical notion, and they were very disturbed by that. But again, I'm going to say this over and over again. This is not about abortion. And if we care about abortion, we have to keep our eyes on the prize, which is the case in Mississippi that will be argued in December. And I don't see these two justices coming out the same way in that direct challenge to Roe and Casey.
Did anything shock you in what you heard yesterday?
Well, I was pleased because, of course, five justices had already permitted the Texas law to go into effect on two occasions. So I was pleased that they actually understood the draconian nature of the Texas law. I don't think that came from a concern about the women who were affected by the law or a concern about the unavailability of abortion. I think more importantly, it was their concern about access to the courts for this issue and every other issue. In fact, more importantly, the other issues they care about, like religious freedom and gun rights.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us, Catherine Kitty Colbert, the lawyer who argued the landmark case in 1992, credited with saving Roe v. Wade, co-founder of the Center for Reproductive Rights, co-author of Controlling Women, What We Must Do Now to Save Reproductive Freedom. We'll link to her op-ed piece in The New York Times. Roe is as good as gone. It's time for a new strategy. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for two positions, Director of Finance Administration and a Human Resources Manager. Learn more at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Berkey, Nina Guzder, Masai Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena. Special thanks to Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Fires burn in America. Fortunately, firefighters are on the job, saving life and property, and you can be a part of it. 7 out of 10 firefighters and emergency responders are volunteers. There's no typical firefighter. Anyone can volunteer to serve their community. Volunteering as a first responder is really about having the heart and drive to make a difference where it's needed most. Your community needs you. Are you ready to answer the call? Learn more and find local volunteer opportunities at makemeafirefighter.org.
I found hope in the midst of an overwhelming situation.
I let go of trying to control things that I had no control over, and that helped me find peace of mind.
Alcoholism is a disease that can affect any family. Everyone suffers, but there is help and hope at Al-Anon Family Groups.
I was constantly stressed and worried. Now I approach each day with joy and gratitude.
In Al-Anon, families and friends of alcoholics find new ways to heal from the effects of a loved one's drinking.
Al-Anon gave me my life back. I'm a better father and husband.
Are you in an overwhelming situation because of someone else's drinking?
Al-Anon and Alateen can help.
Local and virtual meetings are available. Maybe one could work for you. For information, call 1-866-200-0033 or visit alanon.org/hope.
What if the second deadliest cancer in men and women could be prevented? Would you try to avoid the pain? And what if you could protect yourself without leaving your home? Colorectal cancer is highly preventable. Screening is important, safe, and most people have options. Ask your doctor which screening test is right for you. Learn more from the Colorectal Cancer Alliance at getscreened.org.
You are listening to 88.3 FM WRCC Pittsburgh. My name is Paul. I am the Mockster. Normally, you can hear my regular show Friday nights at 9. It's a show called Viva La Mock. I do encourage you to tune in, but you know what? I'm going to take the next half hour and just focus on one band and one band only. Which band is that? Magically, it's a little power pop trio that came out of the Boston, Mass. Area. The Blake Babies.